Greetings and welcome to Edgy Ideas, the podcast that explores what it means to live the good life and create the good society in our disruptive age. My name is Simon Western, and I will be talking to invited guests about diverse topics, exploring social conscious and unconscious dynamics and desires. Welcome to this edition of Edgy Ideas. Today, our guest is Lauren Levy. She has a master's degree in mental health counseling and currently works in this field. Lauren grew up in Southern California, where she rode horses and competed at the highest levels in the American Quarter Horse competitions. Lauren identifies as a queer creative and is devoted to exploring life outside Eurocentric norms. She's interested in how group and unconscious dynamics play out when we work to unravel these norms which entrap us. Lauren, you're very welcome. We're here to discuss queer culture. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Simon. Thank you for having me.
Good. So we had a pre-discussion and we were saying we neither of us feel we're experts on this, but we're just going to share our experience and explore this. Now, I think my audience will be very, very interested in this. Queer culture and non-binary life is all around us, and many people are trying to work out what it means to them and in wider society. Could you just say something about queer culture and what queer means to you?
Yeah. Well, first and foremost, I think we can't have a conversation about queer culture without uplifting and celebrating the fact that Black trans women and other queer people of color have paved the way for us to be able to have this conversation or to live our lives in this liberated fashion. And also, yes, you're correct. I'm definitely not an expert, especially with regard to what it means to live a non-binary life in the traditional sense of what that identity means with like they, them pronouns. But nonetheless,
it's a good question. I think queer for me is a representation of the idea of doing anything outside the norm, the status quo. I lived 27 years of my life walking around the world as a straight woman, very much in denial of my own identity. And so I've gotten to live two lives. And I think that, you know, this idea of queerness, although of course, traditionally being tied to the LGBT plus community, is really an important concept that I think is deeply tied into race conversations and beyond that, just the exploration of life outside what our society tells us we're supposed to be doing or being or saying. And I find it really important and exciting to explore what that looks like for myself and for others. So,
Yeah, no, I agree. I'm pleased you said that because I came across queer theory and queer thinking when I was actually in California. I studied in Berkeley, California, many moons ago, maybe 15 years ago. And I ended up going to queer theology lectures because I was in a theology space at the time. Mm-hmm. And it was fascinating. And I think in California is one of the hotbeds of queerness and LGBT activism. And it was really, really interesting mixing and thinking. And it was the interest I had was the non-binary, the beyond just gender identities, which really interested me. But how we challenge, like you say, Eurocentric norms, the whole kind of package of norms, patriarchy and everything which comes with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What happened to you to make your change? You said you were 27 when you came into your second phase of living.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was definitely an unintentional phased approach. I think I had a lot of red flags throughout my life to be like, maybe you're not so straight. But I definitely ignored those. But in reality, you know, I think my upbringing and some of the things that I saw around me just gave me space to see alternative ways of living. And I think once I was in a space where it was safe enough for myself, you know, to turn my unconscious thinking into conscious thinking and step into my queer identity, I did that, and it's been quite a ride since then.
Yeah. So what's happened? I mean, has it been liberating? Has it been painful? What has it been, a mix of everything?
Yeah. I mean, so I grew up as a very privileged white girl, to be honest. And so I, although female, did not experience very much marginalization or oppression from a systemic level, or others really, pretty much at all. Or in the ways that I did, my other privileges kind of counterbalanced that. But, you know, although my coming out story comparatively to the horrific things that a lot of people that I know and love and people that I don't experience in stepping into their queerness, you know, it's still a huge shift where all of a sudden now you're experiencing marginalization for the first time and microaggressions. And, you know, in my first partnership, I was in an interracial relationship with a Black, queer, non-binary person. And people had a lot of feelings about that, I realized. And all of a sudden, I had to worry about, you know, depending on where we were we safe walking down the street holding hands? Was it an okay environment to kiss my partner on the cheek? Could I bring them to my, you know, friend's uncle's house or dad's house in some experiences without feeling like I was putting them in an uncomfortable situation at the least, and at the most, a dangerous one. And yeah, so I think in that way, it definitely exposed me to, in very small ways, at least comparatively, what it might look like to be marginalized on a regular basis and oppressed. It's like the tiniest taste. Yeah. And on the flip side, it's been absolutely magical and fantastic, because once you liberate yourself to live in a queer body, then there's all this room to shift mental models away from the Eurocentric kind of way of thinking, which takes a ton of unraveling and learning 3 years in here.
Yes, yeah. And it's probably not just Eurocentric, is it? I mean, there's patriarchy in many other societies as well. It probably, and heteronormativity in other societies. So it's Eurocentric thinking is probably what you and I are familiar with, but I'm sure it's broader than that as well, which is another journey. Mm-hmm. Do you find in that you feel like you have a queer community? Are you mixing it with different people now, and how does that kind of play out for you?
Yeah, definitely. I think over the years, my relationships have definitely shifted into more queer spaces, and that again looks to be outside even the LGBT community, and specifically, it has allowed me to, you know, come closer to people who are living outside the, you know, traditional borders and boundaries of what we're supposed to be doing in society, especially with regard to like sex positive living and all the different ways that that unfolds, non-monogamous relationships, polyamory, you know, and other alternative forms of lifestyle, which I think is really cool. And what I love too, Simon, is the last time I was talking, you were sharing about your own queerness, you know, in your body. And I'm just curious how you feel like all of this plays in, because I think in talking outside of the binaries, you know, female, male, feminine, masculine, you are a representation from what I know of you and from what you've told me, that doesn't really fit the traditional mold. And I'm just curious, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting. I mean, I grew up cisgender, as they say, you know, a male body with a very male culture. It was a very, you know, macho male culture. I played rugby and I enjoyed it and I was good at it. And I fitted into that culture. But I also realized later on in my life that I seemed to be enacting something else. And my hunch was that I was the daughter my mother never had, because we had four boys in the family. And I left school. I was kind of partying. I got thrown out of school when I was 16 for being a naughty boy and not studying and all those things. And I ended up working in a factory. And then I found myself working as a male nurse. And it was a way out of the factory. And it was a way I could get a job. People said, Simon, you're good working with people. So try nursing. And a friend of mine was a nurse. And that was interesting because I suddenly found myself from an all-male society, which I went to an all-boys school, to an all-female one. So I was like there was two men in a class of 32 or 33 women. Mm-hmm. And the other guy was gay and I was straight. And it was and suddenly you were othered, you know, you were othered, and it was and you started exploring a different side of yourself, and I found myself very interested in people, in emotions, in all the things which were supposed to be non-male, you know, in the caring professions. And being in an all-female society as a man, you did experience otherness. You were once the exotic other, you know, you were kind of a sought after, you know, male rugby playing sort of man in a female environment. And you were othered in a very negative way. You know, there was sexual harassment, there was role stereotyping, there was lots of jokes. You know, I almost left in the first year. It was almost too painful to be there. It was a very interesting but challenging experience. And then later in life, when I was 26, me and my girlfriend got pregnant and we split up and we decided to co-parent. Mm-hmm. I spent 4 years at home bringing up my child. So from 26 to 30, I was a single parent at home with an infant, going to mother and baby groups again, being the other. And it was just really interesting. And I was really kind of questioning gender role models and gender stereotyping. And I was like, how can men miss out on all this? You know, the idea that men go to work and they're the lucky ones. I was thinking, this is crazy. I was having such a great time. me and my baby, we were on welfare. We had absolutely no money at all, but I just loved it. You know, and I look back on that time as just a gift, really. It was just an amazing time to be, you know, hanging out with this beautiful baby and playing games and stuff. So I've always entered other spaces. You know, when I used to go clubbing, I used to go to gay clubs, mainly because of the dress code of the straight clubs and the violence of the straight clubs, and the gay clubs were just much more fun, you know. Mm-hmm. So being a straight man in gay clubs was you know, that's where we hung out. That's where the action was and that's where the fun was. And so I always enjoy being in different spaces. Never conceptualized it as being queer in those days, but always mm-hmm. very interested in difference and non-binary. And I'd always hang out down in places like Soho in London, which was, you know, where queer life happened, finding it far more interesting than kind of where straight normative life was. So always been very interested in that space, really. And just because it's just so much more interesting, really, and just really never felt comfortable with the kind of trappings of the binary world.
Mm. See, I love that you say that. And I love that you asked me to have this conversation with you, Simon, because it reminds me of what we tend to do. And you write about this in some of your papers about how we tend to we push away the other, say we want nothing to do with them. They're terrible. They're awful, whatever. But really the only way that we can build bridges and create this like social justice world, I think that we are saying we all want, and especially with regard to like anti-blackness and the anti-racism stuff that has been going on for 400 years. But I guess the general public, at least in America, over the last year has sort of come to. I think it's sort of, it's a perfect example of the connections that get lost when we do that, and yeah. how there's so much that we could connect over and build bridges with and empathize about to really like join together and understand each other. When we just project onto other people, which I'm totally guilty of, but have tried really hard to work on doing, in different ways, because there's so much more nuance when, again, we're not just looking at you as a white man, you know? And so I love that you share that. And I think it's so important. And again, I think that it goes into this greater conversation about race and how if we if we can change the way that we are projecting onto others and only being able to see them as Black or Brown or Asian
or white,
and, you know, are able to build bridges in a way that maybe we could even see, you know, the fact that they have multiple racial backgrounds, which a lot of times, you know, someone that I really look up to in group relations work is a biracial woman who in part is from the Caribbean and also is, has, you know, a white parent of European descent. And, you know, I've seen her tear up and get very emotional about the fact that at times or in different ways, either her children or her, or, you know, other people, I can't see the nuance of her identity. Yeah. All they see her or her kids as is Black. And I think obviously that's heartbreaking to hear someone that you love talk about that. And also, why I love that you share your story, because I think it's a way to bring the other in, to these conversations that a lot of times I think they feel like they're not a part of, or they don't understand, or it doesn't relate to them, or whatever, because
frightens them, or kind of frightens them, and they become fragile whites. Or, I mean, I think this is really important what you're saying, because one of the dangers, one of the paradoxes of the queer culture and the and identity politics as a whole, really, is that we aspire to not put people into boxes, into binary holes, to kind of understand the nuances, as you say, and to allow people to be more emancipated, to be who they really want to be and who they really are. Mm-hmm. And yet the identity politics also entraps people. So people kind of get stuck in a new labeling or a new us and them, the kind of progressives versus the conservatives. And you find yourself in a new set of entrapment, and I think that's particularly being played out in the US at the moment. Do you experience any of that?
Yeah, of course. Absolutely. And again, obviously I come from a very privileged position where most of my identities aren't marginalized on a day-to-day basis. Absolutely. I think it's a struggle all the time. And as an example of that, you know, one of my really good friends is Latine and also non-binary person. And, you know, they have told me, and my partner even, you know, is trans and non-binary. And, you know, I hear, you know, the ways in which and see the ways in which people interact with this idea of even them having pronouns outside the traditional, you know, English way of referring to men and female. And again, all of a sudden they no longer are human. All of a sudden, all anyone can look at is the pronouns that matter to them and the stories that I hear and again, see playing out of others trying to grapple with what it means for them to be non-binary or to have they, them pronouns or even split pronouns where it's they / he or her or something else. Becomes really entrapping as well. And I think that speaks to what you're saying, Simon, even when we do find ways outside of the binary, I don't think that our society is very friendly to that. And it can create even harsher marginalization, oppression, than if we kind of just, again, maintain the status quo. And I don't think that we've come up with a great solution to that.
No.
Yeah.
No, I think we're at the beginning of a very potentially exciting and special journey, but also with lots of problems on the way. I was talking to a couple of gay friends of an older generation, and they were talking about how they have some hesitation around things like gay marriage you know, at one level, they say, of course, we fought for equality all our life. You know, we've been activists. That's what we fought for. Mm-hmm. And at another level, they're saying, but all our queer spaces are getting closed down. We're being taken over by heteronormativity. We're going through marriage and we're ticking this box and ticking that box. And all those edgy queer spaces, which we loved, are disappearing.
Yeah.
I thought it was really interesting. And I because, you know, for me, it's like, you know, that was one of the joys of going to gay clubs and going to Soho. You did feel a bit edgy. You did feel like you were doing something different, part of something very much more vibrant. And when it becomes normative, how that can be. I think what they're worried about was how it gets kind of taken over by wider culture and usurped, and then gets normalized and people get fitted into new boxes rather than being able to be all those nuanced differences you spoke about.
Yeah, I think that's a very real threat to these really, you know, kind of at times sacred places. You know, the queer community is not exempt from the same abuse internally or wrongdoings that exist outside. So let's not, you know, make any misconceptions there. But if we're only speaking about the ways in which, you know, the masses and this sort of patriarchal Eurocentric mindset can overtake this really sacred other way of existing, I think that is a really scary thing to think about. And yet I think anyone, and I don't know if you can relate to this, Simon, but once you start living your life in a questioning way where you're questioning pretty much everything, for instance, like you said, the institution of marriage in and of itself, why it is that we are so invested in monogamous, long-term, lifelong relationships with a single person. You know, why within the monogamous relationship, there's all of these rules and structures that apparently everyone is supposed to follow, including the relationship elevator from courting all the way up to we're going to have babies after we get married, and then we're going to, you know, whatever.
Yeah, it's like, yeah.
Once you start navigating that in your own life, there, even with the inundation, which does sound scary, and I haven't thought about it in that way when you talked about it, I think that there's so much liberation in the brain because you can literally live your life in any way, really, truly, if you allow yourself to. And I think on the flip side, we're in some way safe enough because the masses are terrified. And I think that's why, again, similar to the race conversation, people don't want to deal with this. People don't want to talk about it. They don't want to talk about pronouns. They don't want to talk about, you know, all of the alternative ways of living. I mean, these are in ways still very dangerous and underground societies for a lot of people that are a part of them. And I guess in a way it's a blessing and a curse to have it that way. But
yeah. I met you, Lauren, on a group relations conference and online. We never met face-to-face, but we both explored group relations and the unconscious in groups. And I've been struggling or trying to understand for years why non-binary, why people being gay, why people are so threatened by a change in the status. Yeah, it's interesting. You know, someone like my father would, you know, and even in my younger days, we grew up to be prejudiced. That's, you know, we were encultured to be prejudiced, you know, against different races and different sexualities. And people like my father, who's now passed, you know, like in the last 20 years of his life, came around to understand that he'd been kind of conned, you know, and he was very pleased to accept, you know, gay people kind of around him, whereas before he kind of would have judged them. And there seems to be a huge anxiety, you know, in the States it plays out with kind of some really perverse politics that we've seen with Trumpism and the kind of support he gets. I'm wondering why there is such an anxiety around difference. Hmm. It intrigues me. Have you any thoughts?
I think because, and I'm curious your perspective on this, Simon, because I know you've done a lot of work around this. From my perspective, what I think it is people feel very threatened by the idea that they could be living in a way that is nonconformist. I mean, I think people like to really believe that they have autonomy and they're making choices and they're free thinking. And I think it freaks them out when they realize in any way, shape, or form that actually other people in the world are doing something that they could be doing or maybe they want to be doing. And that thought, I think, is so terrifying to people that it becomes unspeakable. And I also think from a more like you know, sort of like brain kind of innate level, I think our brains are wired kind of in a robotic way where we're always trying to make sense of things, as we've talked about, put things into boxes. And in doing that, it's really hard for our beautiful brains to process the idea that there can be a fluid structure, a spectrum of human that exists, and to hold those complexities in their fullness. And even then, in social justice spaces where people say they really care about race relations or, you know, queer rights or whatever it is, rights for women, the nuance gets lost because at the end of the day, we're still just humans. And it takes a really conscious shifting, I think, to stop doing that or to do better at it. But what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a number of things. I think human beings are social beings and tribal beings. You know, we like our tribes, we like our groups, you know, and when our groups get threatened, I think that unsettles us. I think you're right about the, I mean, I think where a lot of people who are threatened make a mistake is that they think that you by finding your own queerness kind of threatens them, when actually it can really liberate people. I think, you know, it's like men, the patriarchy doesn't only just kind of entrap women and other people, it actually entraps men in a way of being, which is hugely damaging, hugely damaging to men, you know. It's not like just liberating the other, it's actually liberating yourself, you know. It's that's what people don't get, that's a bit that they miss. But, you know, Freud wrote Civilization and Its Discontents, and it was all about really how, you know, we at one level we want to be individual and we want to kind of have our own identities, and yet we have to kind of belong to the group and we have a desire to be part of the group as well. So we have these ambivalent desires. You know, we want to be part of a tribe and a group, and we want to be have our own nuanced individuality. And I think we really struggle with that in society. I think that's a massive struggle for people. You know, it's like when people say about white men or black people, as if there's a homogenous white man or homogenous kind of black race, you know, just doesn't exist. But there is also at the same time such a thing as white domination and black oppression. You know, these things do exist. And I think it's difficult. People find it difficult to work between those positions of having a collective way of being, a groupishness and an individuality. And I think that's what we're struggling with a lot. And I think it creates a lot of fear when you start playing with certainties or traditions or ways of being, which have been settled for a long time. Mm-hmm. It's unsettling.
Absolutely. You know, and I love what you said about the downfall of doing this, right? And again, I keep going back to the race conversation, because the way that I've been thinking about it as of late is this idea that, like, if you're not white, you're queer with regard to the way society looks at you. So that's the reason that people, you know, in part are marginalized, besides the fact that white people decided to do that. But, you know, I think that even in racial spaces, you hear the same narrative, which is very true of, like, you know, people of color's liberation and white people's liberation is wrapped up in ending racism as it exists. And yet, for whatever reason, it has become so ingrained and so insidious in our society that it feels at times impossible or disheartening that things could ever change. Although, you know, maybe small changes are being made. I hope that they are. I obviously would not be the one to speak to whether that is the case or not. So I'm also curious, Simon, because, you know, I don't know how old you are, but I see a lot of times too with generations above me that there seems to be also something to do with that playing into, you know, your question about people's lack of desire to engage with these types of conversations. And I don't know, obviously you only have your own experience, but what do you think that's about and how does it play in here?
Yeah, I mean, in the group relations conference we were at, generational issues arose, and they arise in lots of areas I'm working in. And they're not talked about as much as other diversity issues. It's interesting, generational issues don't get the same airplay. But I think it's hugely challenging for people for older generations to, you know, it's like the pronouns thing. It's unsettling. You know, it's like for my generation, we didn't use pronouns. You know, I might have enjoyed difference, but this idea of pronouns, and you know, for people around me, they find it confusing. They find it kind of unsettling. They'd rather things just stay the same. You know? I think generationally it is like my father had to come to terms with gay rights and gay people having rights and accepting that. That was a massive shift for him. I think there's another shift for my generation and older generations to understand what non-binary means. And I guess it's part of the journey. I think that this has always been the case of shifts in generational thinking. And I think there's a very exciting kind of move in your generation and the younger generation again, who actually find a lot of this very normative now. You know, it's kind of normative to kind of talk about non-binary and use pronouns and take on trans ideas and they're questioning kind of, well, in some areas they are and some other areas they're not. Of course, there's a lot of conservative young people as well as progressive young people.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess technically, well, not technically, I'm a millennial and I work with a lot of Gen Zers. And, you know, I think that it's pretty cool to see them, at least with regard to queerness. I know 13-year-olds who are like, I'm non-monogamous and I'm queer and this is what that means to me. And you're right. It seems like it's a lot more normative. And, you know, I think from what I see or experience too, a lot of the reason that the older generation or just people in general, look, like there's people my age who I know very well who have the same feelings as, you know, a 40-year-old or a 50-year-old or an 80-year-old with regard to pronouns or queerness in general or trans folk in general. Where this, it brings up the same shame that racial conversations bring up. And so rather than dealing with it, people just stay silent. But again, as you were saying earlier, the actual only way to work through these things is and to be liberated from the confines and the boundaries and borders that we have here is to do the opposite of that and to lean into our shame and to speak our shame. And, you know, Brené Brown says that shame can't live once you speak it and it's met with empathy. Which is the same thing I was talking about earlier, Simon, where it's like, if I can humanize you enough to look past your white maleness, to ask you about your life and you as an actual human, then I can actually see that there's all of these connections between us that are so important. And then we can be on the same team in some regard, rather than me choosing to not even engage with you because of what I see from afar.
Yeah. And that's really important. And it's very easy, you know, for a white man in a male body of my generation to actually retreat to that position, which, you know, we all receive projections. So from a certain part of, from certain areas, you get projections of privilege, you get projections of what a white man stands for. And it's very, you know, you can retreat into a defensiveness around that very quickly. And I think it's just really important to try and hold open these dialogues, these conversations, and not getting trapped by people's projections and your own fears, really, and own anxieties and own defensiveness. You know, so we have to really work at that level, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, another thing that a dear friend of mine kind of said with regard to this idea of pronouns and non-binary folk, and I think just the queer movement in general, you know, she was saying how painful it is that, you know, Black folks specifically and people of color don't have the same emphasis put on trying to figure out how to address them and their nuanced identities. And it's something that I think about because, you know, I don't know how we can move forward in this society with everything we have going on and actually get to the place that we're talking about, Simon, if we can't hold the nuance, you know, of what queer means and all of its pieces.
Yeah, I really agree. And I think queerness is really one of the most interesting and hopeful aspects of culture happening at the moment. To me, it also links to other work I'm doing. I write about eco-leadership and ecosystems and how we understand the business world in terms of the environment and social justice. Mm-hmm. And I talk about how all these ecosystems come together, you know, sort of technological ecosystem, the environmental ecosystem, and the social ecosystem. And for me, the social ecosystem, this is what we're talking today. We're talking about people, about nuanced people, about difference, about diversity. Mm-hmm. And it mirrors what happens in the environment. You know, if you homogenize the environment, if you get rid of diversity in the environment, the rainforest die. Mm-hmm. It's like part of the whole, how we live within these ecosystems environmentally, technically, in our workplaces, and how we live with each other are all part of the same story. And I'm reading Donna Haraway, a kind of a radical feminist, who talks about how we really have to understand the world in terms of multi-species, you know, beyond just this kind of human dilemmas we have, but really start thinking about how we live with our kins, you know, critters, she calls them, and, you know, the animal world and the plant world and all that around us. And I think it plays into this much wider kind of movement, which is going beyond modernity. And modernity was all about binaries. It was all about science and reductionism and finding answers to solutions in a very linear way. Mm-hmm. And now we're understanding actually we're in a non-linear world. It's complex. It's nuanced. It's kind of, it has to be diverse. Otherwise, it just doesn't work. And I think that's exactly the same for human relationships. It all kind of plays into the same thing for me.
Oh my gosh, I love that. I love that so much. And I think it's so hard to get from point A to point B, but even just like the words that you use, I think, you know, we've talked about how important language is, and this idea of like critters and other species, like those are just words that obviously exist within our language, but that we don't even think about. And I think it's so cool to, what I've been doing in my personal life is thinking about alternative ways of identifying myself outside of the typical intersectional identities, or even conceptualizing myself, which I realize is not even close to, you know, what you're speaking about. It's still very in the structures that exist. But I think it's an effort to just, you know, step outside those kind of molds of what I'm supposed to say that I am or that I am, to think about myself and others in a different way. Which I think is pretty exciting and fun to do. You don't have to sit here and say all these boring traditional things about ourselves to connect or express or show up in our fullness, you know? So.
Yeah. Lauren, listen, it's been really lovely talking to you, really. And I think, sharing your experience courageously and what you're going through gives me a lot of hope and I'm delighted. I ask all my guests before they leave the show to think about what it means to live a good life and to create the good society. And I wondered if you had any reflections at all on what it means to live a good life and to create a good society.
Oh, I think for me, Simon, it's living an authentic life, but a life of questioning and exploration and living where you can in a way that shows other people that they can live outside the borders and boundaries that exist for them, and hopefully in a way that also liberates others in spaces where they, you know, might not be able to do that themselves because of systems or ways of thinking.
Yeah, well, that's great. Great thinking. And I'm going to take away the word nuance from this conversation, how we must always be more nuanced. I think that's really, really important. So thanks again very much for sharing. It's been a lovely conversation.
Thank you so much, Simon. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Edgy Ideas. If you enjoyed our podcast and would like further information about our coach and leadership training, or would like to join our advanced community of practice, where we discuss edgy ideas and much, much more, please contact me, simon@analyticnetwork.com.